Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're jumping into a really high-stakes domain, aerospace and defense systems.
That's right. And we're looking at a huge shift in engineering. I mean, in modern systems, the kind that are mission critical, life critical, the line that used to separate safety from security.
The glitch versus the intrusion.
Exactly. That line has, for all practical purposes, just vanished.
Because the outcome is identical. Whether it's a worn-out component or a sophisticated cyber attack, you get the same result: catastrophic system failure. And when lives are on the line, the pressure to get this right is just immense.
So our mission today is to really dig into the architectural demands this new reality creates. We're pulling insights from Patrick Miller, who's an expert working right at this intersection: embedded systems, aerospace, defense cloud.
We're basically looking for the architectural cheat sheet. How do you build a resilient weapon system today?
Yeah, and the big picture here is all about connectivity. I mean, these systems are now software-defined, they're networked. That introduces attack surfaces that, you know, old analog systems just never had to worry about.
Which means resilience has to be baked in from the start, not just patched on later.
And that brings us to the first really profound idea from the sources. Resilience isn't just about preventing a failure. It's about designing a system that's engineered to manage a failure.
So you're designing it to degrade gracefully.
You are. You accept that a fault or a compromise is probably inevitable. And so you plan for the specific, safe way the system will break down.
That's a huge mindset shift for an engineer, isn't it? You're moving from designing for perfection to designing for a controlled collapse.
Precisely. You start asking, will it fail? Why? And you start asking, okay, when it fails, how do we make absolutely sure the most critical functions keep running, or at least fail in a safe way?
Okay, let's unpack that, this unified threat model. If we go back to basics, what's the classic difference between safety and security?
So traditionally, safety engineering is all about what happens when things might fail on their own. You know, component errors, vibration, wear and tear.
Accidental failure.
Right. And security engineering asks, what happens when someone tries to make it fail? It assumes a malicious thinking adversary.
And the terrifying overlap is in the cockpit.
That's it. When you're sitting up there, a safety failure and a security failure can look and feel identical. If the aircraft isn't doing what you told it to do, you don't really care in that moment if it's a glitch or an exploit.
The danger is the same. That forces architects to solve both problems at once. We're a long way from the days when the only threat was, what, someone physically tampering with the plane?
A very long way. Yeah. And connecting this to risk. The source material makes a great point. Security isn't just tech. You need the technical controls, yes, but you also have to have governance. You need auditability, clear processes.
These are lessons learned the hard way in the enterprise world.
Absolutely. And here's the bit that I think every product manager listening should hear. You have to know your customer's actual problem, not just the requirement they wrote down.
Because the requirement might just be scratching the surface.
Right. They might ask for a specific crypto algorithm, but their real deep down need is to guarantee mission continuity for 40 years. Understanding that why is everything.
Especially as we move to these software-defined platforms, which on one hand offer incredible speed and flexibility, but on the other.
On the other, you have this terrifying new risk. A single vulnerability in one piece of software could, in theory, take down an entire fleet.
But the opportunity is huge, right? If you're starting fresh, you can build in things like zero trust from day one. You don't have to duct tape it onto an old system.
Exactly. You avoid what the source calls retrofitting a house with a new foundation, trying to bolt modern security onto a 20-year-old proprietary OS. I mean, it's not just hard, it's insanely expensive, and you usually just end up with compliance theater, not real security.
And we have to talk about the 40-year problem.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just a thought experiment in A&D. A plane certified today, it's going to be flying 4 decades from now.
Facing threats we can't even conceive of yet. We're talking about a post-quantum world where today's best encryption is basically useless.
So architectural resilience is really the only game in town for long-term survival.
It is. And to get there, our sources point to 3 critical architectural pillars. The first one is just non-negotiable. Modularity.
Meaning you design the system so you can isolate failures and fix them surgically.
Precisely. If a comms module gets a zero-day vulnerability 20 years from now, you need to be able to update and recertify just that module, not the whole flight control system. That requirement drives everything.
And the second pillar, which I think we need to dive into, is strong separation.
Mm-hmm. That's what stops a breach in one corner from spreading across the whole aircraft.
And number 3.
Supply chain transparency. Treating every third-party dependency as an ongoing risk to be managed, not a one-time decision.
Which brings us to the SBOM, the Software Bill of Materials.
Yeah.
We hear this acronym all the time now. For anyone who doesn't live this stuff, what is it exactly?
It's basically the nutrition label for your software. An SBOM is just a formal list, an inventory of all the components and libraries inside a piece of software.
Ah, so when the next Log4j vulnerability hits,
you don't have to scramble and hunt through everything. You just query your SBOM database and you instantly know every single system that's affected and needs a patch. For a 40-year life cycle, that's not a nice to have. It's essential.
It moves you from guesswork to data.
Exactly.
Okay, let's double click on that second pillar, strong separation. This means compartmentalization has to be a primary concern right from the start.
And that requires a real mental shift away from the old security model.
The M&M model, I've heard it called.
Yeah, the hard outer shell with a soft, chewy center. You know, secure the perimeter and just hope nobody gets in. The modern approach assumes failure. It assumes someone will eventually get in.
And when they do, you need internal walls to stop them. I've heard this talked about with networking terms like north-south and east-west limits. What does that mean here?
Sure. So north-south traffic is basically data coming into or out of the system from a ground station, maybe. East-west is the internal chatter between subsystems, the flight computer talking to the navigation system.
And a strong separation architecture locks down that east-west traffic.
It has to. If your comms module gets popped, the attacker shouldn't be able to just hop over to the flight control actuators. You have to stop that lateral movement.
And how do you enforce that in a real-time embedded system where, you know, every microsecond counts?
That is where separation kernels come in. A separation kernel is a type of specialized hypervisor. It runs at the lowest level of the system, and it creates these incredibly strong hardware-enforced boundaries between different software partitions running on the same chip.
So it's like a digital firewall built right into the hardware level.
That's a great way to think about it. And it guarantees two critical things. One, a partition can't access another's memory. That's the security part. But two, and this is crucial for safety, one partition cannot mess with another's timing.
Ah, so if a non-critical system goes haywire and starts hogging the CPU,
the safe-to-critical flight controls, running in their own protected partition, they just keep executing perfectly on schedule. They don't even notice.
That's the two-for-one solution. You're protecting safety and security at the exact same time.
And you need that kind of isolation, especially when you think about something like a UAV, an unmanned aerial vehicle. The sources point out that for, say, a cheap, single-use tactical drone, the calculus changes.
You might accept more technical risk to get it into the field faster because there's no pilot on board.
That's the argument. But I think we have to push back hard on that disposable framing.
Because even if the drone itself is expendable, the capability is not.
The capability is definitely not. If an adversary captures that drone and reverse engineers it, they get everything, our tactics, our sensor tech, our communication protocols, the whole playbook.
So the design priority flips. The system doesn't just have to complete the mission, it has to prevent intelligence extraction. Protecting the IP is now the number one security requirement.
Right. So the same architectural principles apply. Strong separation, key protection, data at rest. It doesn't matter if a human is on board or not. The asset you're protecting is the knowledge.
So for a team trying to modernize, the advice is not to boil the ocean. What are the first practical steps?
Start with data, always. Measure your top three security gaps and measure your top three performance bottlenecks. Then look for the overlap.
And we learned that strong separation can actually improve performance. How does that work?
It's all about resource contention. On a modern multi-core processor, if you have one big OS, a misbehaving task can easily block a critical one from running on time. A separation kernel dedicates resources, a specific core, a memory budget, a time slice to each partition, so they can't block each other.
It makes the system more predictable.
And predictability is performance in a real-time system. So yeah, the security architecture actually makes the system run better. That's a huge selling point.
And to make this happen faster, you need the right pipeline.
Oh, absolutely. You have to invest early in DevSecOps, automated testing, static analysis, all of it. That's what gives you the confidence to move quickly without breaking things.
And all of this is being pushed by regulators, too. Mm. On the defense side, you've got the DoD's software fast track initiatives.
Yep, and the zero trust mandates that are forcing this kind of internal compartmentalization everywhere.
And in civil aviation, you have standards like DO-326A, and DO-356.
Which are finally moving the industry away from a simple compliance checkbox.
and toward continuous monitoring for the entire 40-year life of the plane.
Exactly. They recognize security isn't a one-time problem you solve. It's a living process.
So let's bring this all back to the end user, the pilot in the cockpit. What does all this invisible architecture actually mean for them?
In a word, trust. It means they can trust their displays, they can trust their controls. They have to have complete confidence that when they give an input, the aircraft will execute it faithfully, and that the data they're seeing is real.
And if something does get compromised, say a minor sensor on the network,
the expectation is that it's contained. It stays in its little box and can't escalate to the flight controls. And if a system does fail, it fails safely. It gives you a clear warning. It doesn't just do something unexpected and catastrophic.
It lets the pilot focus on their real job. Aviate, navigate, communicate.
Exactly. You know, the engineers did their job right if the pilot never even has to think about cybersecurity. It should just be part of the background integrity of the aircraft.
So to wrap this deep dive up, safety and security are now two sides of the same coin in aerospace and defense. And they both depend on the same architectural pillars: strong separation, modularity for updates, and constant supply chain vigilance with things like the Espion.
And that final takeaway for everyone building these things: always go back to the customer's actual problem, the true operational need. Don't just build to the written requirement.
Because that's just the start of the conversation.
Right. Once you understand the real priorities, is it maximum safety? Is it intelligence protection? Is it speed to field? Then you can make the right engineering trade-offs to deliver real resilience.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought. You're designing for a 40-year lifespan. We're on the cusp of post-quantum computing, which will break today's crypto. So how do you design a system today that's future-proof when the very medium of computation itself might fundamentally change?
That is the next great challenge. Architecting for a future you can't predict. And that's something for you to think about as you apply these concepts.